The Tom Woods Show, episode 708.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, I have a 93% male audience, so I know you are looking for that smooth and comfortable shave that, if you're like me, has always eluded you. Well, I'm glad to say the coupon code is up and running at harrys.com, where you can take $5 off their Truman set and join the ranks of cool guys everywhere. Use coupon code Woods at harrys.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. A big shout out and thank you to the tens of thousands of you out there who've been making listening to the Tom Woods Show part of your daily routine. Makes the whole thing worthwhile. Well, another thing that makes it worthwhile is getting to talk to Ron Paul on the show regularly. Ron Paul has been a friend of the show since it began. And in fact, he sent us a nice message in particular on episode 500 to celebrate episode number 500. But we've talked to him quite a few times in the past. And today I thought I would have him on, ask him some listener questions, but don't ask about Clinton and Trump. I think I almost said clump there. Clinton and Trump, I figure we're going to give the guy a break. You know, enough's enough. Let's let him talk about things he finds enjoyable. I got the questions from the Tom Woods Show private Facebook group. Entry to there is via supportinglisteners.com. And we got some good questions for Dr. Paul, and I think he and you will enjoy them. Ron Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Every time I have you on, since I feel like I've exhausted all the questions I could come up with for you over the years, I solicit questions from listeners because I don't want you to have to answer the same old thing over and over. So I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to ask you about Trump or Clinton the whole time we're talking.
Oh, that's good.
It's going to be a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, that's good. Everybody wants to push me. When are you going to do this? And when are you going to do this? And they all have an idea of what I'm supposed to do.
Well, I have to say, I feel like I can't not at least ask, though, because everyone wants to know. Have you taken an official position on a particular? Are you going to vote for Gary Johnson? I mean, people are curious about that. I do understand that.
No, I haven't decided, and I've answered it on national television when they do ask me that. Do I have somebody that I will vote for? And at the moment, I don't have that individual. Still looking.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe that's a segue into the first listener question. Somebody wants to know, who are your heroes? He said, I want to know who my heroes' heroes are.
Well, you know, I think when people talk about heroes, a lot of times they talk about generals and things like that. I think since I've spent so much time trying to understand the freedom message and the non-aggression principle, the person that I looked up to the most for various reasons, because he was very successful in doing the work, he knew how to do it, the tone that he used, and he was also quite capable of raising money, and that is Leonard Reed, you know, for the Free Thief Foundation. And I just think he was a heroic person. And he also, you know, permitted me to find materials. Today, you know, we all get spoiled. You just click. You know, you can either find something that you want, or you can buy a book or whatever. So, but that was all. Leonard Reed was before that, and I was on the board at one time at Fee, and been to the Fee Foundation quite frequently, and I always liked it because he was very supportive. But he also was one that really understood what I was doing, because he didn't think politics was the answer, that education was the answer. And of course, he influenced me in that direction. I still think that is true, but obviously I still dabble in politics at times.
Where do you stand on the subject of whether libertarians are being hypocritical if they accept various government benefits like subsidized student loans or any of the whole laundry list of programs?
Well, you know, I think some people can make the argument and justify, well, they took this money from me and I'm taking it back. I think if it's confusing, I let people make up their own mind. But it's one of those things. Okay, for instance, I can sort of look at what I did and try to analyze in that light, that I was drafted into the military out of my medical education, and I ended up, you know, on active duty 2.5 years and on the reserves 2.5 years. So it was disruptive, and I took a pay for this. The part of the pay that came from other taxpayers would go into providing educational funds afterwards. And I took that, you know, and I don't lay around feeling like I did something horrible because, you know, I'm not somebody that right now I'm more for getting rid of a lot of our military than back then. But still, you know, I was figuring that it's a legitimate function. You can get paid. And if I used it for education, I wasn't going to go on a guilt trip for it.
Well, what about people who either work in government jobs or who work in industries that are very close to the government? They get government contracts. I know you've said it's okay to do it, you can be paid, but what about working for the military-industrial complex? Is there a point where you say this just can't be done?
Oh, yes, and I think morally speaking, there is a moral element. You know, I claimed I was able to take a legitimate pay in Congress, but I didn't feel that it was morally proper to take a boondoggle retirement fund, you know, which I thought was ripping off the taxpayer. And it was beyond, you know, what I thought was proper. But I think all war profiteering, I think that it's horrible. You know, if they really, you know, it just should not participate in the argument. And you might say, well, what's it like when a rip-roaring war is going on? Are you going to take away all the profits? Well, no, you couldn't do that. You wouldn't have anybody doing it. But I think especially when you have the military-industrial complex living in an age like we have today, fighting constantly and lobbying for more aggressive activity and bombing and killing, and as soon as a bomb is blown up, oh, we get to bomb, you know, build more bombs. I think that's immoral, it's wrong, it's bad economic policy, and most of it's unconstitutional. And I believe that anybody who gets very wealthy over that system should be, you know, it should be eliminated. We shouldn't do that. And I join in with those on the far left to saying, you know, that 1%, they've earned their money in a immoral fashion. But instead of being like a Sanders and just say, well, the rich are bad people and take it away. If you can, you should work very hard to make sure that if a person is producing a product, if they're making a computer for you, and they haven't, you know, been working for the government, and they're rich because the consumer voted them rich by us buying the product, I think that's entirely different for them to be wealthy. So I have no objection to wealthy people if it's honestly earned, but I have a strong objection to it when they use the government or they get the bailouts from government, and there's so much corruption in the financial system, you know, with the World Bank, IMF, and our Federal Reserve. I mean, it's all part of a globalist control of financial interests. But the good news is it's all going to fall apart, and we'll have to start from scratch pretty soon. And hopefully we have more influence on how we rebuild this system.
Let's take a quick moment to have you talk about the conference that's coming up for the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, September 10th. This is 2016 as we're recording this in Virginia. Tell us about that, what's going to be discussed, and who will be there.
You know, that will be at the airport near Dallas, so that people can come in and they don't have far to go. And our speakers are coming in. Lou is coming, and Bumper Hornberger will be there, and Brian McGlinchey is going to be there, as well as Colonel Larry Wilkerson. And these are all very important. And we're going to have some more as they commit to coming, other speakers too.
Well, it's a great event. I mean, I'm glad to see the Ron Paul Institute doing things like this and having outreach like this. Can you tell us something about Larry Wilkerson? Because I know he's a prominent figure, but I don't remember much about his bio.
Okay, he was the right-hand man for the commander-in-chief during the Iraq War, the commander, and he was a right-hand man, and he's changed to become, you know, anti-war. But he has a total military background, and for that reason, he's very significant.
So that's terrific. So I'm going to have a link to that. Obviously, the conference is advertised at ronpaulinstitute.org. I'll have it up on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/708. Got some more questions here. People want to know, I don't know about you, but I find it hard to come up with what my one favorite movie or my one favorite book is. Too hard to narrow it down, so I won't ask you that. But what would you say are your maybe a few favorite books that have meant a lot to you over the years?
Well, probably the ones that I got more excited about were economic books, a lot of stuff that Murray wrote and Mises wrote, because I was struggling with trying to understand it. And I think that most people who are honestly looking for the truth have a pretty good understanding of how things should run. But I was not secure with thinking that I was, on the right track. But it was such a delight to find people that I highly respected writing and explaining this stuff. So when I heard the explanation of the business cycle, I remember reading Murray Rothbard's book on the Great Depression. I was raised in a Republican home, and I was told, well, the whole problem was is the Democrats in this Congress was messing around with Hoover and made Hoover do bad things. And then you read Murray's book, and you find out there were bad ideas involved in monetary policy and the policies that were initiated by Hoover were also the ones that that FDR took on them and continued them.
I think as a libertarian, I feel like as I go through life, I find myself confronted not with a whole lot of brand new objections that clever people have come up with, but it seems like the same arguments again and again and again. Years and years, decades and decades. So somebody wants to know, is there one or two, or there maybe one or two particular pro-government arguments that really stick in your craw? As one of them said, the kind of argument that actually makes Ron Paul utter a curse word. And if he were to do that on your show, it would be astonishing. It would be amazing. I'm not encouraging you to do that, but I mean an argument that really just drives you so crazy, you just lose your patience with it.
Well, sometimes it doesn't bother me a whole lot, but it is a problem, and that is when the political correctness steps in and people say something and it sounds like he's a terrible bigot, and then he gets punished for it through the system of political correctness, both legal and just pressure. I find that detestable, but I usually try to handle that by saying that, the First Amendment wasn't produced for us so we could talk about the weather. It was there so that we could say controversial things and become patriots and criticize our government when they get out of hand. So they have just a twisted understanding of that. But there's a lot of people even today, about First Amendment, that what you can say and do. They deal with First Amendments and they totally exclude, property rights. And I think most issues of First Amendment can be dealt with the property, and religious freedoms. It's property. You can do with it what you want, and you can have people in. You can talk about things and print and, all these things. But the left doesn't believe in the civil liberty of keeping what you earn or running your own life and spending your own money. They don't understand that, and many times they consider that a civil liberty according to their understanding, rather than allowing the people to say what they want and do what they want and do controversial things. And my position is let them do whatever they want, assume the responsibility for what they're doing. If they have benefits, they can keep it. If they goof up, they have to, be responsible for themselves. And that, I think, is the important way to look at that, and the government should just stay out of it.
I want to go back to books for a minute. I've sometimes advised people, if you have somebody who has an open mind and says, I'm willing to listen to what you have to say, make them this offer. Say, all right, I'm going to give you a book, and then you give me a book about your views, and we'll read them and we'll discuss them. And that, if they feel like you're reading what they have to say, they're more likely to read your book, and that may open some doors. So suppose you were in that position. You're faced with some young people. Yeah, I think you have been in this position a few times. You got some young people. They're curious to know. What would you have them read? It can't be Human Action. So what would it be?
Yeah, it can't be. It should be simpler and easy and making maybe one crystal clear point. That to me is the law by Bastiat, because it is based. It is the principle of non-aggression that you and I can't do. We can't do harm to anybody else, and the government shouldn't be able to do it either. But so often there's this giant leap of faith. You and I can't do this, and we have to be regulated because we're bad people, and the government has to protect us from ourselves. And that, and the point being, the government can't do it either if we're not allowed to. But today, the government's allowed to use force to do whatever they want.
Let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor and come right back. Friends, I had two rituals when I was in college. One, every day trying to do or say something that would make people think, I'll put it that way. And also every day making myself a bloody mess trying to shave with a blade. This happened every single day. I'm a bloody mess every day. So I finally just gave up and thought, I guess I can't use a blade, I'll have to use electric. And we all know, despite what those companies say, it's a crummy shave compared to what you could get with a blade, but it's better than being a bloody mess. But I am very happy to share with you my solution to this problem, which is Harry's.com, where I got their Truman set for just 15 smackers. I got the razor handle, the moisturizing shave cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, they're giving you guys a special deal. They'll give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code WOODS. So head on over to Harry's.com right now, look for the Truman set, and use promo code WOODS, and you'll get free shipping and five smackers off. I personally got the best shave I have ever gotten, and I bet you will too. Check it out at Harry's.com using coupon code WOODS. All right, I've got this question. How about from your career as a physician? Is there a particularly memorable episode or something that happened that you're fond of recalling, like any story from that part of your life and career?
No, I think it's just general, you know, the satisfaction that I got. Sometimes you would be very tired if you had to get up at 2 in the morning and having only been in bed for 2 hours and thinking that you're going back to work and you're very, very tired. But I think the experience of that, because we made the commitment, I decided to go into OBGYN. Nobody forced me to it. But I think after you wake up and go and do your job and you get a new life into the world, and the mother and father are delighted, and it avoids all the discussions of unwanted pregnancies and all the other tragedies in the world, that new life still would elicit, you know, a lot of positive things. And I was always amazed. This is probably as a individual and as a parent and grandparent, noticing that if there's a newborn that comes home, just a small baby or a baby that's 1 or 2 or 3 months, if they have some sibling there that might be 2 or 3 or 4 years old, they're so attracted to it, and they just have this natural instinct to be very positive. And I don't know if you experienced, but you certainly have had some experience with a few girls, so you may as well experience this where you saw the older siblings. And to me, that was part of medicine, you know, that it was a joy. And it's frequently said, and this is a positive thing about OB, is that, you know, when you get sick and you need help and you go and you have to have surgery, you hurt, and the best they can do is get you back to normal. But in OB, when things go well, which they generally do, they end up taking something home, and they give the doctor more credit than the doctor deserves. But the doctor gets identified with that. So most OB doctors, when they take good care of their patients, are really you know, well received, not only by the patients but by the families as well. And I still see this, you know, today. You know, when I go around town, some people will stop and want to talk to me and say, you know, you delivered me, you know. And that was on the campaign trail. There was one story that I think I was in Idaho or someplace, and a woman that ran the large facility for the fun that we went, the gathering that we had. We had several thousand people, 3,000-4,000. But the woman that was running it said she wanted to talk to me afterwards. So they said, okay, we'll do this. So in the back, she came over, and she had something in her hand. She says, I want to know if you'll sign this. And it was her birth certificate. I had signed it, 25 years ago, and here she was running this thing. So I signed it again. I said, this is the only birth certificate that I've ever signed twice. So she was ecstatic about it. It was an interesting story and a break from some of the terrible things that happened in campaigning.
Well, that even beats getting Greenspan's autograph on the old Ayn Rand newsletter. That's fantastic. All right, who do you think is carrying the torch for libertarianism into the future, bringing your message into the future? And that could be political or non-political.
Oh, well, I think non-political and does a lot of hard work and promotes the cause and does a lot of writing. And I think his name is Tom Woods. He does a fantastic job.
I appreciate
that. Then we have a guy like Lou Rockwell. I've known him for a long, long time and wrote his first fundraising letter to get the Mises Institute started in the early 1980s. So he has done a whole lot in a non-conventional fashion. I mean, he just, not many people would have ever predicted back then that the Mises Institute would have a presence like it has now. So, but I think there's a lot of people like that. I think the neat thing is, it to me is like the remnant. You don't know where they are. I hear so many stories of people, that got involved in our campaign when they were 16 years old in 08, and they're running things. You take Jeff Frazee, what he's done with Young Americans for Liberty. He was he just got introduced in my office as an intern and then went to in our campaign in 08. And he reaches out to a lot of people. So, and people ask, these important people, what do you tell me to do? I want to be one of those important people. And my answer is sort of glib. I say, just do whatever you want. Everybody has to make a choice. And there's a bunch of them that make good choices. They just have to have a desire. Everybody has a role to play. No matter where you think you are on what your understanding is, if it's lack of understanding, and I felt like I experienced that in the 50s, that the college I attended didn't give me the answers, and especially throughout the 60s, along with studying medicine, it was when I became fascinated, with Austrian economics and the predictions made, and a guy came across Henry Hazlitt, an individual I know you're very much aware of, and as a matter of fact, I did something on our website this week about Henry Hazlitt, predicting about the IMF. He says the IMF is a total failure and terrible, and he was absolutely right, and now we have an IMF that's totally out of control now, but under the gun, because people are talking about, do we really need an IMF? Obviously, we don't need it, and the world would be better off if we didn't have it.
All right, one other thing I just can't help asking. I won't mention the nominee's name so as to keep my pledge to you, but Bernie Sanders, we know, endorsed the Democratic nominee, which I knew he would, and I definitely knew he would when several weeks ago Paul Krugman predicted that he wouldn't. Then I knew for a fact he would. So I guess my question is, what do you think happened there? Do you think it was just a matter of he thinks that's the best thing to do? Do you think there was some funny business behind the scenes? And was there anything like that with you? I mean, were they trying to twist your arm in 2008 and 12?
Oh, and 8 and 12, not really. I think they knew my answer. It was sort of like the lobbyists didn't come see me because, I was too bullheaded. I wouldn't, yield. So they didn't really bother me. And for Bernie, I think he's more in the pragmatic world. His views on foreign policy, the things we agreed on weren't as firm. I think he had a pragmatic viewpoint. The utilitarians and pragmatism allows, a lot of degrees. And sometimes the decision is made for purely political reasons. And he went longer and harder than most of these candidates will. And he had a tremendous following. But here, those followers think that, well, we're not going to fade. We have to stay in our guns. But he, my guess is that he probably say, well, it's time. I can't win. I'm not going to be the nominee, but I'm going to join, and I'll have a better chance on, raising taxes and giving free stuff out, and if I'm part of the issue. But it will annoy the strong supporters, and I think the people who were most annoyed were the ones that were hoping that he wouldn't join for the military reasons, because he was, you know, he came across a lot better than Hillary on warmongering, and I think there was some disappointment there. But I think he's a pragmatist, and I think that's what most everybody in Washington are like.
You should have seen his Facebook page, which I checked out the day of the endorsement. It was just thousands and thousands and thousands of people just absolutely disillusioned and demoralized. They could not believe he had led them this far and started this movement and lit everything on fire and then walked away from it. They couldn't. They were saying, "You've betrayed us." They just unloaded on him. It was unbelievable.
Well, I'm not surprised of both that he did it because of what I just said. And I'm not surprised that these supporters took that attitude. And I sort of sympathize with the supporters because I don't think I think somebody has to give the most crisp understanding of what we in the opposition believe in. So if we believe in the gold standard, we have to know what gold standard. Should it be an honest gold standard? Should it be a gold coins standard? Should what should it do? Oh, no, we'll have a modified one. We'll have a gold reserve standard, and the American people won't be allowed to own the gold, and they go in. So, no, we have to have people, defending their position on principle. And they said, yeah, that's good for the academics, but not for the politicians. Well, they said you have to be pragmatic. You can't be one of these people that are so bullheaded that you won't even give in. But I just disagree with that. My goal was different. I was offered a lot if I played their ball game, and if my goal when I was elected in 1976 was to just stay there, work my way up, through seniority, raise money for the party, voted the way they wanted me to, I could have been the committee chairman. Then I could have done those things I really want to do, which is always the saying. Well, if I'm there, then I'll have a better position. But no, I had no interest in that whatsoever. To do it that way, I was trying to, send a message about what these principles are all about.
Well, I'm thrilled about your event that's coming up. I hope people will attend. It's 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, September 10th. So it's not a huge commitment, but it's in, I guess, Northern Virginia, with some great guests. And of course, I assume naturally you yourself will be speaking.
I'll be there.
All right. So how can people not go? I'll have all the details at tomwoods.com/708. And Ron Paul, thanks for being a good sport, answering sometimes off the wall, but nevertheless interesting and penetrating questions.
Okay, Tom. Good to be with you.
All right, everybody. I want to let you know about a new blog you might want to check out. It's ancap308.com, ancap308.com. It's brand new, but it's got a lot of, ANCAP insights on a variety of subjects, everything from minimum wage laws to helicopter money, so-called, as well as Keynesian versus Austrian economics, and the pretty good question, why do a lot of people not see the obvious? We ask ourselves this quite a bit, don't we? We wonder why more people aren't getting things the way we seem to get them. Well, these sorts of topics and more are explored at ancap308.com. It was a blog started by a Tom Wood Show listener, and if you start it through my special link, then I give you a little shout-out on the show, plus that extremely valuable backlink on my site and a couple of dozen free video tutorials to make you an effective blogger. So if that interests you, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, tomorrow we're talking Libya, Syria, and the U.S. government and what it's been up to there and what the results have been. So very interesting. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.